what I have been saying, I would like to reiterate an important point. As you might remember, we had spoken earlier of what Sri Aurobindo had said about the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, and it is this resurgence which causes the impasse. Now, in that context, Sri Aurobindo has made a further statement, a qualifying statement, and if that qualifying statement remains unchallenged or unchanged, then the peril is very great, and there might even be a failure of human species as a human species. And I would like to draw attention to that qualification that Sri Aurobindo has made, and I would like to elaborate upon it. This is on page number 1052, and I shall repeat a few sentences which I had already read out to you earlier. And Sri Aurobindo says, the first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminates the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive peoples. But it is the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril, and this we see all around us. Now, it is at this point Sri Aurobindo makes a very important statement. For that is bound to come if there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Now, this is the important qualification. In the first place, it is a fact that today there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us. Secondly, there is no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. If you look at humanity at large, these two things are not at all to be seen prominently, or to the degree to which there ought to be. And if this situation continues, then the peril is very great, and all the other consequences of the failure of human species would follow. I would like to dwell upon this particular point, and I would like to say this is the impasse. The impasse arises from the fact that there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Fortunately, I am anticipating the argument, particularly because we were told about Orwell. The development of Orwell and the ideal which lies behind Orwell precisely attacks this particular point of impasse. Orwell proposes to put before us a spiritual ideal liberating man from himself into his inner being. If you read the charter of Orwell, if you read some of the statements regarding what Mother has said, what an Aurobindian ought to be, where Mother has laid down fundamentally that the Aurobindian lives an inner life. The fundamental proposition of a person who lives in Aurobind, that he lives an inner life. And one can live an inner life only if there is a spiritual ideal, which liberates the man from his outer being and leads him to lead an inner life. This has happened. And this is why we can say that Sri Aurobindo, the Mother, have worked out so as to propose to the mankind so powerfully that a township is being proposed where people who can be inspired by the spiritual ideal can come together, live together and lead, first of all, an inner life. And secondly, this Aurobind also implies a liberation of the mind in such a way that a mental and moral ideal begins to spread throughout the humanity. And this is an aspect which is not sufficiently understood by people in Aurobind themselves, but it is implied that the very existence of Aurobind implies a kind of attraction given to the mental and moral capacities of human beings. The capacities which can control and uplift the vital and physical man in us. So since you had asked this question about Aurobind, I would say this: the relevance of Aurobind is central to the whole planning of the work that is envisaged before us. But I would still like to dwell upon this question of the impasse which has been created by the absence of the mental and moral ideal. And we have to realize this fact that at large in humanity there is at present a kind of a weakening or even conspicuous absence of the mental and moral ideal which can control and uplift the vital and physical man. This is the thesis that I would like to develop, if possible today, and may continue later on if there is no time today. But I would like to dwell upon this, and we must understand this quite well. And in this context, therefore, I would like, first of all, to speak of what is rationality, because what is mental ideal? Mental ideal is the ideal of the rational consciousness. And what is moral ideal and what is ethical sense in man? And how these two important powers of humanity today, at the end of a cycle of the development of the reason, where they stand. And for that purpose, I would like to reflect on this question and share with you my reflection. As far as the mental ideal is concerned, as everyone knows, it is the Greek civilization which has given to the modern world, at least, a tremendous push towards the mental ideal. The Greek civilization itself may be regarded as a civilization of the human mind, as distinguished from the Indian civilization, which may be called the civilization of the spirit. Not that in the West there was no spirituality and there was no spiritual guiding light, but the fact is that that spiritual light has remained dimmed under the overpowering influence of the Greek civilization, which became highly mental in due course of time. At the same time, it is not true that Indian civilization was not mental. There is no intellectuality, on the contrary. But the fact remains that Vedic civilization developed the intuitive powers of consciousness, spiritual powers of consciousness to a very high degree. And when there was a danger of that high achievement being lost, a very remarkable phenomenon arose in Indian history, and that was the development of the Upanishadic age. As Sri Aurobindo says, that if you compare the history of India and the history of Greece, whereas in the beginning of Greek civilization, there was a powerful spiritual movement, greatly illustrated by the Orphic tradition, Eleusinian tradition. And in India, there was a Vedic development. The two were parallel. But whereas in the West, in the Greek civilization, following the Orphic elements, when that began to become dim, there arose a kind of an evening of spiritual light. And to my mind, Socrates and Plato represent the splendid colors of the evening light, where reason began to preponderate and the spiritual light was thrown into the background. In India, however, when the Vedic light began to be dim, and it did become very dim in the period of Brahmanas, but in the period of Aranyakas, once again there was a new stir, and in the Upanishads we get a brightness of that stir and a reassertion of the light that was available to India in the Vedic period. And therefore, in a more clear language, the Vedic civilization's truths were reasserted. And therefore, Upanishads became the foundation of the next cycle of development. Therefore, intellectuality did come, as in the West. Here also, intellectual age did come, but not immediately after the Vedic age. The Vedic age was followed by ritualistic age, which was followed once again by the spiritual age. And then came the development of the intellectual age. This is what makes a tremendous difference between the cycles of the West and the cycles of the East. This will also show us, when Sri Aurobindo says, basically, there is no opposition between East and West. If you read the message of Sri Aurobindo given to America in 1949, Sri Aurobindo speaks. He says that while I give this message to America, my message will equally be applied to India and to the East as well. And he also points out there is no such great division between East and West. But the difference has arisen only because of this emphasis which came to be laid upon the rational element in the Western civilization, and the emphasis on the spirit that was laid in the Indian civilization. Now, I am referring to this because I would like to mark out more clearly how rationality developed in the West and in the East. And this will give us, if you trace out very quickly the whole history, we shall see where we stand and what exactly is the nerve where we are now arrested, both in the West as also in India and the whole world at large. Let me therefore begin with a very remarkable philosopher in the early Greek period, namely Parmenides. Not many people are aware of Parmenides, but I would like that something of Parmenides is underlined by those of us who would like to study the history of rationality in the West. I have before me a book in which a very short sentence is given from Parmenides, which gives a precise formulation of the illustration of how rationality came to be articulated so sharply and so clearly in the following sentence of Parmenides. I am only stating this statement and I will not dwell upon it, although one can give 2-3 lectures on this sentence to analyze it. But I will not do it because I want to move rapidly through the history of rationality in the West and the East, just to show the impasse in which we are and how we can break it. Parmenides says, "Thou canst not know what is not, that is impossible, nor utter it, for it is the same thing that can be thought and that can be." Now, this is a very difficult sentence. It is very well articulated. And from my point of view, this statement has never been refuted in the whole history of thought, either in the East or in the West. Although many people believe that this proposition has been refuted or can be refuted. But this is my personal reading, and I would like to underline this one sentence, and I shall pass on further. In future, if you would like to be precise about the statement, I have read this particular statement from Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy from page number 56 for those who want to see and read those two sentences, because that is the most important statement of rationality as it develops, the source of rationality as developed. I'll just read once again. "Thou canst not know what is not, that is impossible, nor utter it, for it is the same thing that can be thought and that can be." Now, on account of this particular statement, Parmenides is able to assert that reality has got to be permanent and static, and that motion is impossible. This is the starting point of the Greek rationality, which therefore is throughout in the Western thought. To grasp rationally is to grasp that which is permanent, that which cannot be changed. Therefore, rationality came to mean, at least in the beginning, that which is rational, which cannot be altered, which is permanent. And the assertion of the permanent became the hallmark of philosophical thought.